Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was the theater like in Shakespeare's day? While many fans of the Bard recall the names of places like the Rose and the Hope and the Globe, the original structures have been gone from London for hundreds of years. Yet understanding exactly where and how those theaters operated can tell us a great deal not only about the kinds of productions Shakespeare intended, but also about day-to-day life in Elizabethan and Jacobean England. As senior archaeologist for the Museum of London, Julian Boucher has taken part in excavation projects at the site of several of the city's notable 16th and 17th century playhouses. He's in town for the Boeschel Family Lecture Series tonight at 7 at the Dallas Museum of Art and was kind enough to make time to talk to us about his work. Julian, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What did you need to learn about the dramatic arts as an archaeologist in order to take on these projects?
I think the understanding of the dramatic arts, the function of the building is a secondary point, really, because many of these buildings were actually built in the same sort of rather vernacular style as any other building of 16th century London. Now, they happen to be a slightly different shape, and more importantly, they encompass a differing function. So it's when we get to the function that we're interested in talking to, obviously, actors, to try and understand what went on. We can dig up some walls and we can say they're this date and we can say it's a house or a theatre or whatever else. But yes, it's the understanding of what goes on inside that's particularly interesting.
When you say different shape, these weren't just rectangles. These were polygons, sometimes with 14 sides.
Absolutely. In actual fact, for the Rose, we know that had 14 sides. For the others, we're really not certain as to how many sides. But they had to be polygons, yes, simply because of the method of construction. The Elizabethans did not have the technology to bend timber, although they did in a small way for ships. So it's an area enclosing a large sort of, not quite circular, but almost circular area, which has a seating galleries around the edge and a yard in the middle. So, and you're projecting towards a stage where the action happens.
I was surprised to learn that before the excavations, I suppose I had assumed that there would be lots of documentation about exactly what these structures looked like and how they functioned and how they were built. In fact, there seems to be sort of a dearth of sketches and of written descriptions of these places at all.
That's right. It's very interesting. The most informative written descriptions are, in fact, usually from foreign visitors to London who regarded these as novelties. And, in fact, one of them, a Dutchman, described them in the way that a Roman theatre might be from the pages of Vitruvius, the great Roman architectural historian. He hadn't seen anything like this. So they give us some clues. It's also, in fact, a Dutch drawing that is the only detailed drawing of the inside of one of these theatres, the Swan Playhouse. And that was only discovered at the back of a cupboard in the University of Utrecht in the 1880s. So, you know, this evidence has been slow in coming forth, if you like. Otherwise, there are plenty of legal papers. Nothing's changed. Theatres go through the same sort of discord as everything else.
When you talk about legal papers, I suppose there were a lot of disagreements with landlords and the people who wanted to occupy the space.
Yes. It's mostly a question of leases, of tenancies, of these playhouses. And if you read through them carefully and you don't die of boredom in the meantime, you can get a number of physical details of the building, which is certainly what I'm interested in. Sorry, I'm sure lawyers are interested in the other half as well. but they make interesting reading as you try and analyze those discussions.
So you knew that these were located near the Thames, but how in the world do you go about figuring out exactly what site to start digging at?
Well, it's rather the other way around in London, because most of our archaeological legislation is associated with the planning laws. So that if somebody wants to build a new office block, a new hotel or whatever, and that project, that development project, is situated in an area that is described as archaeologically sensitive, then there will be a planning condition on that development. And he will contact archaeologists like us from the Museum of London to go and excavate the site first.
What is the process? How do you go in there and how far down is everything buried?
That's really a process that we've built up over the last, 40, 50 odd years. We might have looked at something next door to this new project 10 years ago, and we have an idea of how deep things are. We'll certainly be doing a lot of research as to what might or might have been on this particular site to give us a clue what we're looking for.
And in addition to looking for the structure of the building, obviously there's a lot of sort of detritus around that gives you clues about how it was used and when everything took place.
Yes, absolutely. You might not be digging a single period site either. You may have to go through centuries and centuries to get to something like, for example, a playhouse from the 16th century. There may even indeed be earlier remains below that you want to have a look at.
Tell us a little bit about what London was like as a city around the time that Shakespeare was living and working there.
Small. Mm-hmm. A lot of people seem to have been rather seduced by the modern notion of speed and transportation, thinking that, for example, the two main areas of theatrical development in London in the 16th century were in Shoreditch, which is just north of the city, and on the Bankside, which is on the south bank of the Thames. And people think, wow, you know, they're a long way away. Well, they're not, actually. They're only a 45-minute walk apart. But people are seduced into thinking, you've got to get the underground from one to the other, or the bus, or whatever. And you didn't actually have any choice. You had to walk. So London in, let's say, around about 1600 AD, was a growing city. By that time, there must have been at least 200,000 people in London. But it's still small enough to walk from one end to the other.
What would spring up around a theatre district?
Again, it's probably the other way around. Mm-hmm. It's not so much a theatre district. It's a district of varying degrees of bureaucratic and political control. The theatres, for example, were not really tolerated inside the city of London because that tended to be under a more of a sort of Puritan-minded jurisdiction. And theatres were not terribly well regarded. So they tend to be situated outside the city. In the Bankside area of the South Bank, for example, there were gambling dens, houses of ill repute, bear baiting pits, and so on, all of which was regarded as immoral. So theatres arriving on the scene is part of the same sort of activity.
Let's talk for a minute about bear baiting. I have to confess, I don't normally care about sports, and this one is really appalling, but I had never been aware of this thing that was apparently a big part of sort of entertainment around this time.
It's frightening, isn't it, how popular these venues were. King James I of England, for example, was a great devotee of bear baiting. And there were quite a number of these things, about five or six, again, mostly concentrated on the South Bank. What is of interest to us, however repugnant we might find the activity today, is that the architectural setting of them, and quite possibly the economics of them, were very similar to the playhouses. We have descriptions from people going to the playhouse one day and the bear baiting ring another.
which is like pro wrestling, essentially.
It's weird, yes. But there are these links, and we've been able to look at a couple of these bear baiting rings as well, where we found bear dogs, bear bones, dog bones, and so on and so on, to try and see what's going on inside. And yes, there are some of the literary descriptions as well.
Are there clues in Shakespearean stage directions about the shape of the stage, or the size, or the distance from the audience?
Very little, but we've I think been able to complement this sort of information by the archaeological process. When we are looking at things like stage directions, they possibly were not written down at the time. They may have emerged later through the use of that particular text, through performative development and so on. But they do tell us occasionally things like they come in one door and go out another door, so we might know about doors. We might know about how many people are in a particular scene on stage. There's only two or three, or there might be 15, so you need to have a look at how big a stage might be. What we certainly learnt at, for example, the excavations of the Rose Theatre, is the complete kind of churning up of the ground immediately in front of the stage, which to me really suggests that people are pressing right up against the front of the stage, almost like a modern pop concert.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that when this research was first announced to the public, people were very interested to hear about hazelnut shells that were thrown all over the floor. But this was not about snacking. It was about structure.
Absolutely. I think the press went wild about that at the time, and it's a good story. The actual floor that the Yard of the Rose and the Globe we found was made of a very hard, compacted material that included hazelnut shells, which are, in fact, a waste product of the soap-making industry. And one person's rubbish is another person's building material. It's all a good symbiosis. So that they're just building it. We did indeed find loose hazelnut shells. We did indeed find walnut shells and this, that, and the other that almost certainly were food waste from people watching the plays. We know that you could buy a glass of beer, you could buy a meat pie, you could buy fruit, and sit there eating and drinking, or stand there eating and drinking during performance. So we know that consumption went on, yes.
How big were these theatres?
They ranged. The earlier ones were small. The Rose was about 72 feet in diameter. And certainly actors who came to have a look at it were quite impressed by what they described as the intimacy of that relationship between actor and audience. The later ones are certainly bigger, but we're not fully certain. The Globe, for example, must have been somewhere between 85 and 95 feet across. So it's bigger.
And they were several stories tall?
Well, there is written evidence that they were three stories tall, three tiers of galleries. We only find the foundations, but again, archaeologically, you can look at the strength of the foundations, and if it's just a weak thing that's not going to support a great superstructure, then it may not have had that many stories. But others have quite a solid foundation, yes.
So they were built of wood, but what was used at the foundation?
Stone and brick.
Mm-hmm. And so I suppose masons would have been called in, and then were there just sort of laborers for hire that would have built these buildings?
Probably. They would have been. There wouldn't really have been such a thing as an architect. It would have been a master, a builder, quite often a carpenter, a tried and tested carpenter. He would have got laborers to dig the foundations to put stone in there, and it's just largely uncut stone. Then bricklayers, who are the professional bricklayers then as now, would lay the foundation walls, and on top of that, the carpenters would come and build the timber framework for the building. And there are, of course, many of these buildings of this type, of this constructional type, still surviving in Britain today and elsewhere.
So Shakespeare was part of this company called the Lord Chamberlain's Men, mm-hmm. and this was sort of an investor, actor, writer group that would come together and put up some of their own money to build these things.
In that particular case, yes. The origin of most of the acting companies was, again, part of this governmental slight unease about theatrical activity, and regulations were enforced that any acting troupe had to have the patronage of one of the royal officials or nobles at the court, and in Shakespeare's company's case it was the Lord Chamberlain, which is an office of the court, of course, who was the patron of this particular company. But yes, he would try and help them politically. But they needed to put up money here or there to buy themselves costumes to put towards new venues and so on.
Julian Boucher is my guest. He is senior archaeologist for the Museum of London. He's in town to address the Boeschel Family Lecture Series at the Dallas Museum of Art tonight at 7. You can find information about the appearance at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you would like to join our conversation, have a question about the kinds of theaters that Shakespeare worked in, you can give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
When the dirt walls and a little tiny boy with a hey ho, the wind and the rain, a foolish thing was but a toy, for the rain it raineth every day. When that I came to man's estate with a hey, ho, the wind and the rain, gates, thieves and knaves, men shut their gate. For the rain, it raineth every day. A long time ago, the world began with a hey, ho.
A little audio element to suggest Shakespeare's London and the theater performed then. My guest this hour is senior archaeologist at the Museum of London, Julian Bauscher. He's in town for the Beauchel Family Lecture Series at the Dallas Museum of Art to talk about his work in excavating Shakespearean playhouses in London. If you'd like to join us and ask a question, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. The wind and the rain is an interesting thing to talk about here because the original design of the Rose Theatre had the stage completely exposed to the air.
Well, it did, as far as we know. There was certainly no big permanent roof to it. It may have had a cantilevered awning or something. That we can't tell from archaeology alone. And it's probably part of the concern about actors, let alone their expensive costumes, that made the owner, Philip Henslow, build a roof over it in 1592, 5 years after it was first built.
Well, it is amazing. I mean, everybody loves London, but it's not known as a fair-weather town.
That's right. That's right. These playhouses usually only perform during summer, a bit like the modern globe we have in London now as well, although occasionally they did perform in the winter. But yes, you certainly feel for people standing out there in the rain.
Any idea what they did to light the stage, or were these performances mostly during daylight hours?
They were always during daylight hours. Mm-hmm. We know from various of the poets who were writing at the time that the performances started at about 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And you'd have a play probably performed faster than they are today. And you might end up with a musical piece or a fencing performance on the stage, something like that, and everything would probably be over by six-ish.
Was there such a thing, I guess, in reverse order as a show and dinner? Or what did people do before and after? Did they just make their way home?
Well, theoretically go to work, but because it depends what sort of audiences we're looking at. There are descriptions of various noble gallants who would have a whole day out at the playhouse where they may start having a glass of wine there, and then they'd go on and they'd go perhaps to an indoor theatre as opposed to an outdoor playhouse. They may go to a concert. They may even go to a bear-baiting performance.
On a really lucky day.
Yeah.
You mentioned, later on a roof was brought in. And I think one thing that's really fascinating about reading this work of yours is that these were works in progress. We think of them now as these things that are sort of resting in antiquity, but they were doing trial and error, basically, to figure out what worked the best.
Yes, this is part of the whole history of theatrical development, from ancient Greece to today. People have different notions of performance, different notions of what can be performed, how you can project that performance. So building a roof over the stage also means you could lower things onto the stage, a sort of deus ex machina. On a simpler idea, you can have a trapdoor in the stage where things can come up. So there are all sorts of what we would now call special effects being developed at the time. And I think that a lot of the playhouses at the time that we know from documentary sources were developed, enhanced, elaborated, are probably all part of a theatrical competition. Now, this must have come from the actors and the playwrights, as much as the theatre owners, who would be interested in a greater income, of course.
Julian Bauscher is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with John in Wichita Falls. Hi, John.
Hi. My question is, how many people would these theatres hold, and about what kind of price would be charged for a seat in the theater, at least in today's dollars? And I'll take my answer off there.
Thanks for your call.
Hello, John. The idea of calculating a complete audience capacity is a difficult one. For the Rose, we made some capacity estimates for the central yard of the thing, which is simply by covering out the square footage somewhere else and packing people in. And that gave us a figure of about 500. So we're guessing that the Rose, which is about 72 foot in diameter, may have held about 2,000 people, possibly a little over. There are descriptions saying that the Globe, which we know was bigger, held 3,000.
That's a lot of people in a small space.
Sure. But they didn't have, I mean, unlike, for example, the replica theatres that we have today, the Sam Wanamaker one in London and others around the world, in the Tudor period, they didn't have any health and safety concerns, so you could pack people in without any worries. Now, in terms of paying to get in, the earliest and simplest system was paying one English penny, which I'm not sure I can calculate into cents at the moment, but an English penny in the 1580s, let us say, to get in. And if you wanted to go through the yard up into the galleries and have a seat, you paid a second penny. Then came the notion of the box, or at the time what was called the Lord's Room, where you could pay up to sixpence.
It was interesting to understand the earliest use of the term higher standing. It had to do with you paid more to stand higher and see better onto the stage.
It's a sort of, it's been described by one famous theatre historian as a vertical sociology, in that you sit at the top and you can probably see better, and you stand at the bottom, not even on a seat, and your view is even more limited, yes.
You mentioned that people didn't have health and safety concerns. They didn't have health and safety inspectors, but I take it the demise of the Rose Theatre was an outbreak of plague.
Not really an outbreak of plague. That affected many of the playhouses at the time. The government authorities would shut them down because of plague. But in that particular case, it was probably just pure economics. It was also competition from the newly arrived Rose. It was also rental concerns for the ground rent. So there are a number of factors here.
Is there any sense that obviously they were competing with one another? Is there any sense that they used the buildings to be better than the other facility? Did they decorate these places the way we decorate theaters today?
Oh, definitely. There is a description of the Fortune Theatre built in North London in 1600, which describes a lot of carved woodwork, a lot of paint here and there, and it must have been quite an elaborate place. If you've been to the London Globe, the modern London Globe, that's trying to recreate this idea of your surroundings, of your fairly well-decorated surroundings.
What do you think about the modern Globe?
I think it's great. The whole point is to have a working theatre giving the idea of what it was like at the time. The modern Globe does have health and safety concerns, thank goodness. It does have facilities and all the rest of it, but it's giving a sense of what it was like at the time.
Much more expensive than sixpence to get into the best
sure.
seats there. Mm-hmm. I guess you have evidence that men, women, and children attended these performances.
A lot of that evidence comes from documentary sources, yes, but we have also, again, enhanced it by archaeological remains. We've found, for example, children's shoes. We found small items of women's costume. But this is usually what various audiences have lost and left behind for later archaeologists to find.
What do you do with an object that doesn't seem to belong there, that either can lead you to some brilliant new theory about some use or some function within a structure, or could just be there completely by accident? How do you decide?
I think we have to rely on our expertise and our experience of looking at, for example, Tudor London over many years to see where these sorts of objects might appear within daily life. Might they be associated with theatres? Might they be associated with different functions or trades? Or just with people? As I said, you know, we find pieces of dress accessories, rings or clasps for clothes and this sort of thing. For example, at the Rose, we found a couple of swords, the hilt of one and the blade of another, that may have been props on the stage.
How would people have arrived at the theater? Was it strictly on foot, or were there facilities for parking your horse?
I imagine there must have been some sort of horse parking facilities. I don't know about them. The bulk of the population would certainly have arrived on foot. Interestingly, those playhouses that were on the South Bank, in that Bankside area, that's the Rose and the Globe and the Swan and the Hope, was not that far from the only bridge across the Thames at that stage, which is London Bridge, but also ferrymen are known to have made quite a good living ferrying people across from the city to the South Bank.
Is that the reason that they were located by the river, because it was easy to get to from the other side as well?
That was almost certainly one of the concerns, yes. But as I say, it was that particular area was a well-known center of, quote, entertainment, and also in association with an area outside the rather Puritan city control.
When you first uncover an artifact of some kind, obviously it has to be protected from the elements because it's been underground for all this time, but what do you run back with it to a lab somewhere, or do you package it up and leave it there for, you know, days on end while you pull out other things from the same location?
No, the archaeological teams we have on a major excavation like that in London, we'll normally have one of our conservators on site with us, so that, or it depends on what we think we're going to find. When we find it, we can simply telephone one of our conservators and say, look, we think we've got something interesting here. Can you come down and lift it up, package it, and take it back to the lab with you? So we have quite a sort of wide-ranging series of experts that we can call on within the museum world. And we have a very good conservation department who are very well known to look after varying types of objects in various types of condition.
Is this work all government funded, or are there private individuals who are really passionate about preserving London's antiquities?
It's a mixture of things, but I guess the bulk of it, certainly from my department, the archaeological department, is actually private funding through, as I say, the planning controls. If you want to build an office block and there is something deemed to be of archaeological importance below, then that developer will have to fund the excavation.
Oh, the developer. Okay. Mm-hmm. And are you working then under time constraints? Do they say, fine, you have 8 months to get this done?
Absolutely.
That's got to be really stressful.
Construction costs are rising all the time, as we know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Shaker in Plano. Hi, Shaker.
Yeah, hi. I visited one of these places in London. I don't remember the name. And I found out from the guide that the place was so packed that when people wanted to relieve themselves, there were some boys who would come by with buckets. Is that true?
I haven't heard the story about buckets, but it's entirely plausible. There were certainly no, as it were, toilet facilities within the theatres at the time. A lot of people sometimes took a bottle with them for that purpose, and otherwise would have to go out into a quiet corner of the building, perhaps, or outside.
There were sewers and drainage facilities around these buildings. Were those essentially for flood control, or what were those
yes,
for?
Yes, yes. They're actually irrigation ditches. The word sewer had a very different meaning then than it does now. And in fact, the sewer authorities, the commissioner of sewers, would get very upset and fine people if he found that they were putting waste in the sewers, which, as I say, were, as you've mentioned, flood control irrigation ditches.
Rightfully so, I guess.
Oh, yes.
What is the most interesting thing that you have discovered? Is there anything that you haven't yet figured out what it's doing there?
Probably a lot, and I think that it could be said that for most archaeological projects, the more we learn, the more questions it raises. Mm-hmm. But I think it's trying to look at something as a whole, an integrated view. I wouldn't necessarily want to pinpoint one structural element or one object. It's how you look at it as a whole. And certainly in terms of the playhouses, what we've learned is quite fantastic, because we're now putting flesh onto the, as it were, the documentary bones.
Were they really susceptible to fire?
Well, there's the we know of two of them that burnt down. The most famous burning, of course, was the globe that burnt down on the 30th of July, 1613. And it was apparently down in 2 hours. So it shows you how combustible these things could be.
But then they went right back the next year, right, and built the
oh,
second
yes.
one.
Yes, yes.
Were the theaters always in a position to, how did people find out that a production was going to take place?
Word of mouth. We've learnt quite a bit from a lot of the diarists of the time who talk about hearing of a new play, the playhouse owners would often get playbills printed and distributed amongst the populace. They'd put them up in taverns and so on and so on. And if you were near one of the playhouses, you'd have a trumpeter at the very top blowing his trumpet, and you'd have a flag run up to signal the almost imminent performance of a play.
So you didn't buy your tickets in advance. You showed up that day.
You showed up that day. I don't think you got a ticket. You just paid your money and they let you in.
Mm-hmm. Is there any sense, do you think, that the kinds of spaces they had to perform in affected the way that plays were written?
That's a difficult one, because it's only very recently that we've had a look again through archaeological sources about the shape of the stages. What does seem to be the case is the earliest one, say, at the Rose of the 1570s, was a fairly flat-fronted stage. So it looks as though you're performing frontally in front of you. Later ones, like, for example, the reconstructed Globe, is more of a thrust stage. So you're performing almost on three sides, and that brings us to the sort of modern concept of theatre in the round. Because after the playhouses were closed, just before the English Civil War and the Puritan Commonwealth, after that, when all the famous Restoration plays theatres opened, they were frontal, and they developed into this later proscenium stage idea. So the idea of going back, the theatre in the round, is going back to the origins, perhaps.
Are you able to speculate on what the acoustics were like?
I think we assume it was good, and the words of Shakespeare's description of the wooden O will give us a clue about the kind of a resonance of a wooden building generally, and it depends on your style of delivery. Edward Alleyne, for example, one of the most famous actors of the time who performed at the Globe, is said to have had this great stentorian voice.
Julian Bauscher is my guest. He is senior archaeologist for the Museum of London in town for tonight's Beauchelle Family Lecture Series at the Dallas Museum of Art. That address takes place at 7. You can find information about it at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Another bit of recording that sounds old enough to have been taken in Shakespeare's day. We are talking this hour with Julian Bauscher, who is senior archaeologist at the Museum of London. He's in town for the Beauchelle Family Lecture Series at the Dallas Museum of Art. He'll be talking about his work excavating the sites of some of the theaters in which Shakespeare worked. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I was interested to read that theaters were not the only place where plays were performed. They were also done in inns and in sort of multi-purpose halls.
Yes. Obviously, drama goes back way before Shakespeare and way back before purpose-built venues were produced. I guess the earliest ones are probably court performances. If the king or queen demands a performance at the beginning, usually of religious drama, at court it would happen there. Later on, there are the houses of the great aristocrats, the halls of the livery companies, the halls of the universities of Oxford and Cambridge, and then, of course, in the inns, yes. And it really develops, I guess, sometimes for economic reasons, in that, like today, if you have a street performer and he'll put a hat on the ground, you don't have to put the money in it. But if you have a door through which you have to funnel a paying audience, then it makes it into a more viable concern.
We have an email here from Kay who wants to know, is there any evidence of regular contemporaneous reviews of Elizabethan plays?
Not in a formal sense, no. We have comments from the letters of A to B, but certainly not in a formal sense.
Why and when were these theaters ultimately raised?
You mean...
Raised, R-A-Z-E-D.
Yeah. Largely through political concerns. As I say, the growth of Puritanism that led to the English Civil War. In 1642, they actually passed an Act of Parliament saying that all stage playing shall be forbidden and they should be closed immediately. We know, for example, that the Hope lasted for a few years after, but they mostly had animal baiting shows there anyway. So, yes, it's largely a political measure.
It's hard to imagine London without the theatre.
Absolutely. And in the 1660s, at the restoration of the monarchy, with jolly Charles II, who was known as a fun-loving guy, the sudden explosion of theatrical life again, but in a different form, was apparently welcomed by all.
So after that gap, were the theatres that were constructed then very different in terms
yes,
of...
Yes, yeah. they would have been indoor theatres from the 1660s. But it's this period before the what we call the Shakespearean period. The earliest one was built in 1567, the last one in 1614. That, although they lasted till a few years after, that particular period, that flourishing of that... dramatic explosion of Shakespeare, Marlowe, and all their contemporaries is a very finite period.
So how far down in the ground do you typically have to go until you know that you're finished?
It depends what's on top of, of let us say, a Shakespearean playhouse, and it depends what's underneath. There may be interesting things underneath. Certainly, in most cases that we've looked at, it's about 6-7 foot. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell what was built after that is no longer there?
Oh, certainly, because starting at the top, we have to go through the later developments and then carry on going down till we get earlier and earlier and earlier. So, yes, we can build up a picture of the development of that particular site.
And then what happens when you're finished? How is it almost a painful process to just move Earth back into that space that you've spent painstaking months in?
I think archaeologists have become fairly pragmatic about these matters. Mm-hmm. And as I said, 90-something percent of these excavations will be pre-development of the site. So the builders will have wanted the site cleared in advance of any construction they're going to do anyway. What we have to do is retrieve all of the archaeological information before that clearance starts.
What sorts of there's a lot of pottery that's around. Were people cooking right outside? Were the actors eating backstage? What do you think is the reason for all that?
That could have been a number of reasons. The pottery from certainly the Rose and the Globe excavations has been analysed in terms of how many of them were cooking potteries, how many of the because we're talking about yesterday's plastic.
Mm-hmm.
How many of these pieces were for cooking, for consuming, for drinking? A variety of purposes, dishes, bowls, this, that, and the other. And the majority is consumption, yes.
It is surprising how much textile material lasted, because I would think that that would biodegrade in the soil very quickly.
Well, again, yes, we're quite pleased with the amount of textiles that we did find at the Rose. Very small scraps, but things that can tell us about the type of dress that was being worn. But it's largely ground conditions. If it's slightly organic, then it preserves textiles better.
You mentioned earlier that most of the written accounts come from people who were visiting from other countries. Is that because these places were so commonplace and so well known to people in London in their day that no one would have thought to describe them?
Well, that's the theory. But then, of course, when they were first put up, they would have been new as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose it's also who is writing these descriptions. I think we're generally talking about fairly well-lettered people.
Are there any assumptions that we can now make about Shakespeare that we weren't able to make before these excavations took place?
I think it's the drama, and as I've mentioned, you know, perhaps ideas we're getting about actual performance. The idea of the hustle and bustle inside one of these playhouses. and what impact they might have had on local economy. That's certainly important. So we're not going to learn anything more about Shakespeare the man or any of his contemporaries, but we're learning about the environment that he was part of.
Are there any sorts of accounts of people who were there when the theaters were being built or taken down? I know one of them was sort of taken down in the middle of the night, essentially.
That was one called, confusingly enough, The Theatre, that was taken down in 1599. It cannot possibly have been taken down in one night. It would take months to dismantle it. And its timbers were brought over the river to rebuild in this new venture called The Globe, but it cannot simply have been a reproduction of the earlier one, which was 20 years earlier. They would have wanted to have built something new.
So they salvaged what they could and
yes,
then added
absolutely.
To it.
That's really the economics of construction, because it's only within the last 200 years that the economics have changed from the cost of materials to the cost of labor. And as archaeologists, we're always finding reused materials.
Were buildings painted commonly at this time?
Internally, they could be. Certainly, the playhouses are said to have been painted. We certainly did some analysis on timbers to see if there was any trace of pigment, which we didn't find, but we do have references that many of them were painted, yes.
What kind of conditions mean that a piece of timber that's been buried underground for hundreds of years will last as opposed to one that breaks down very quickly?
Well, as I say, it's the soil conditions. Yeah. If the soil has any kind of organic content, if it's been sealed and still retains an organic content, it will preserve timbers, leathers, fabrics. Leather, for example, we found an awful lot of leather shoes or pieces of leather shoes, which were preserved quite well. If you're out in the country in perhaps a rather dry environment, you're really not going to get that sort of preservation.
There's some really interesting photographs in the book of representations of these things, and I suppose this is why I'm not an archaeologist, but it seems hard to tell from what they look like today what they had been. Is there sort of a guidebook that you look at and look at similar pieces that have been found in the past and identified to be shoes or pants or something?
Absolutely. There are different specialists. There are shoe specialists, there are fabric specialists, there are timber specialists, which certainly in the Museum of London I'm lucky enough to work with. And yes, we have reference collections. Yes, we have a number of publications. But it boils down to experience of many years and going to ask experts, say, well, have you seen something like this before? I said, oh, yes, I think I have somewhere in a book somewhere, you know, and so on and so on.
When you pick up the phone to make that call, they must be delighted to hear that there's some new puzzle to work on.
Everybody loves a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And even if you can't answer it directly, it's that journey towards the answer where you learn so much and try and discover so much about what was going on in the past in terms of the physical surroundings.
Do archaeologists tend to argue in a friendly way with each other as much as other disciplines do about the use of things?
Yeah. Of course. I think certainly most of the objects I've been dealing with, we have little dispute, but we will certainly thrash it out, yes.
So what went up over these excavation sites? What's there now where the Rose and the Globe and the Hope used to be?
Where the Rose was, there is now an office block, but there's a basement which has preserved the space around the excavations. Above the Globe, there is actually a building of the 1830s, which is a protected building, so that's still there. But the sort of open area where we found this rather small portion of the Globe is still an open area. It's been covered over and made into a nice yardway. Mm-hmm. The theatre in North London, which we've only found a small bit of, is actually covered by about four different properties, so we're unlikely to look at or preserve the entire thing, and so we've only found a very small segment of that one.
So the basement that was created and the space was kept aside, is that specifically so that scholars can go back in another 50 years and take another look?
Who knows? It would be a nice idea.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us at think@kera.org. My guest this hour is Julian Bauscher, who is senior archaeologist for the Museum of London. Let's go next on the phone to Julie in Arlington. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Chris. I just wanted to tell your guest, my husband and I just returned from London a few weeks ago and went to the Globe for the first time. We've been to London several times, but this is our first trip to the Globe. It was absolutely delightful. But the main reason I wanted to call is to say that to give a plug for the Museum of London. I was there in 1977 as a college student, and I've always wanted to go back, and I just said to my husband, you know, I really want to go back to this museum I went to back then. And we went, and it was just great.
Well, thank you so much for calling.
Well, thank you. I think it's great, too.
Are the things that you found able to be put on display, or are they not organized in that way? Are they sort of cataloged in a back room somewhere and just kept safe?
It's a bit of both. As you know, most museums have collections that are far larger than the capacity for display. We, like many museums, will have moving exhibitions of, you know, this theme or that theme, and then when the exhibition's finished, they will go back into storage. Some items will stay out. We do, for example, have some of the Playhouse items that have been there for a number of years now.
How do you handle everything? Is it obviously you're wearing gloves when you're working with these materials, but are you in a special sort of climate-controlled room when you're actually physically inspecting things?
When we're excavating it from the ground, we'll just pull it up, and as I say, we'll get in touch with our conservators who will take it back and look at it under appropriate conditions, yes.
Are there any mysteries that that you have yet to sort of figure out that still keep you up at night? Or
I think one of our greatest questions is about the globe, because such a small area of it has been found. And however exciting the Rose discovery was, the globe is Shakespeare's own playhouse, so it has a greater appeal. But we're not fully certain of its size. We're not fully certain of its stage dimensions. We'd like to know much more about the globe, but to say half it is under a protected building, so we may never find out, but who knows.
Are those regulations that require excavations before something is built, are they relatively new?
Most of them came in the late 1980s, mm-hmm. Because there was a boom year, really, or years in London for the construction industry. And so many things are being found. I mean, London is a moving city. We have development going on, not so much this year. and we have a rich history as well. So we need to really, cater for both areas of work.
Were you ever tempted to keep anything that you found?
No, because I'm much more interested in studying it.
Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that it's there for everyone.
Absolutely.
Julian Bauscher is senior archaeologist at the Museum of London. He's in town for the Bauscher Family Lecture Series, which takes place tonight at 7 at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can find more about that appearance at dallasmuseumofart.com. And you have a book coming out very soon. And what's the title?
We have an account of the Rose and the Globe excavations, and that's going to be published by the Museum of London later this month. It's written by myself and my co-author, Pat Miller, and it's called The Rose and the Globe, Playhouses of Shakespeare's Bankside, Southwark Excavations, 1988 to 1990. You can find that on the Museum of London website.
Julian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.
Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.